Accession number 20065, Reel 7.
Janusz Korzeniewski, Reel 7.
Well, and the assessment came, Ramin, and started shouting, who lit the fire, who lit the fire? And the foreman, this Polish foreman, he ran to him, and he was on your section, and he hit him, and he said, who lit the fire? And immediately he pointed at me. So he rushed to me and hit me several times, but just hit me and walked away. And then, afterwards, all prisoners, all of us, well, not so much myself, but other people, were laughing at John and said, well, you are such a great Pole that when the Zesman come and slap you once on the face, he straight away pointed a finger at innocent boy instead of taking the blame for himself. So he was so ashamed afterwards of this incident, that whenever he had a parcel, he would come and give me some extra food, and was to the end of the camp, he was always, always very embarrassed and exceptionally polite to me for just blaming me for making the fire which he taught me himself to do it. I want to mention to you another thing. Well, it happened with my friend Mietek, whom you interviewed before. That once on this machine, when I walk, suddenly something, there was a short circuit in the machine, and it was 550 volts. And then I felt, I started shouting, crying, because both my hands were on the handles of the machine. There were two movements on the machine, parallel and diagonal, and have to each handle controlled each movement. So I had both hands on these things, and I felt this horrible shock, and I couldn't let the go handle go, and I felt my heart was going all the time. I even remember it today. Every next stroke was slower and slower and louder and louder, and then I collapsed. And the reaction of the people around me, it was my friend Mietek, who came and he tried to take the mallet from the machine, because I had a mallet to lock the parts, take the mallet of the machine, and he wanted to knock probably the switch off. And the mallet, he got a shock, so he dropped it. And then he moved backwards, and then he kicked the switch on the machine, which was more or less against my belly, so he had to put his foot between the switch and my belly, and he switched the machine, and I fell backward, and I collapsed, and the people picked me up because I was unconscious for a while. So in a way, he saved my life this way, you know, I think he saved my life. But I must say that I was so badly shocked and burnt, and I had a burnt mark on my hands and between my fingers, that even German in the camp gave me 3 days off. So I was resting for 3 days off, and I was more or less sleeping all this day without eating, without... Well, I woke up only for something to eat, and it was a continuous 3 days sleep. And what I would like to add as well, that this last stage in the concentration camp was this, which I remember most. Well, and I'm not going to mention the killing, because the killing and murdering was going all the time, continuously, which everybody knows that all the camps were the same thing. And German terror was intensifying sometimes. Sometimes we were coming back from the factory, because we had to go in the evening. Well, it happened twice like that, I remember. Probably it happened more. When we were coming back from the evening, they hung the people in the Appellplatz for some offense. I'm not sure what offense it was. And all prisoners were ordered to... They were given the order by the SS to turn and look at these people who were not actually hanging, but but hanged, and look how they were hanging on these jeeps. And just to remind us what is going to happen if we are going to misbehave ourselves. But these offences for which you can be sentenced didn't matter very much, because you can't be probably hanged for stealing a potato, but you had to do something, these things, otherwise you wouldn't survive if you had a chance, you know. Not everybody had a chance to steal something, you know, I never had, but if someone was working in the kitchen or doing whatever he was doing, he had the opportunity, and he was hungry, or he was probably stolen, not even for himself, but for his friend, which he could have been blamed, you know, probably could or not, which is a different matter, but the Germans were hanging people like that for nothing. They were even hanging people because what was going in the camp, the people were also writing, we had a kind of a sometimes in the evening cultural meeting, and just in order to get away with this awful reality, we are saying, whoever remembered from bits of a poetry and literature, so we're reciting to each other, and some people even writing. So if the person was found with a pencil in the paper and something written on it, he could be just as well killed for it, and it did happen. And so you know, you never... Well, I haven't said very much about this thing, because it was so obvious, everybody is staring here, that you never be certain what's going to happen in the next half an hour, and there was always in the back of your head this fear, which you try to push away from yourself and to think about something else, like I used to go sometimes in the evening and look at the sky, how we are here and there, and you got the consolation that at least the sky hasn't changed. It kind of looked at us with kind of a benign indifference, as it does in normal times, so you could just go a bit outside yourself and calm your nerves and explain everything, and to see probably in the proper perspective. But it needed an effort to the great extent. And then, you see, in this part of the year, 1945, the bombing intensified very much. So they had the bombing raids going on, and Germans were very upset and were very frightened, and there was a strange kind of a psychological effect on us, on the Germans. They were frightened, and the bombing threatened as much as it did Germans, but we're not, because we thought that they are our allies, that they are probably saving us. So I'm really looking forward to these bombings, and the German was very apprehensive, because they were coming, 1945 in the summer time, sometimes they would come, well, say, late in the afternoon, and they would go out like that throughout the night, and benefit for us in the Steyr was when they knocked out the power station, we had the time off. We were just there lying on the tables and resting and everything in the morning. Sometimes in the morning electricity was restored, but the war progressed, there were more longer and longer in intervals without power. And even later, after even light fighters or long-range aeroplanes were coming, and they were flying so low over the camp that the German assessments were really scared. They are running for the cover, and were just because whenever I was on the night shift during the daytime, I was in the camp and I was just looking at these aeroplanes how they were blowing the German guns, and they were diving. Sometimes I thought they were going to drop the bomb in the middle of the camp, but just when they came close to the ground, they were knocking the artillery, anti-aircraft artillery around near the encampment. Because I suppose where Germans were never very sure whether they are not going to bomb Steyr or Messerschmitt workers, but also when they, at the beginning, when the bomb plates were starting, there were sirens blowing, and we had, they drove us, thousands of people from the camp and from the works to underground tunnels. And the rumors were spreading that in these underground tunnels, one day they are going to drive us in, blow the entrances and gas us all. And there was afterward, there was evidence after the end of the war, there was a real intention. And for some reason, the SS men apparently didn't obey the order. You know, I think it is probably, I don't know very much about all this thing. Probably it is, you can find something in the literature what happened. I think it's this book which is mentioned there, that is more described this thing, why they didn't gas us. But this driving us into the tunnel was also nerve breaking, because there were 20,000 or 10,000 people, I don't remember how many, but there were many, many thousands in these camps. And whenever there was alarm, we had to run, which was probably a kilometer away, probably less, probably 800 meters away from the place where we were. And there was a narrow entrance, and the tunnels were probably hundreds of meters. There was a maze of tunnels in the mountain. And through these narrow one or two entrances, 10 or 15,000 people had to go in half an hour time. So they were standing with the dogs in the whips at the entrance and beating the people, kicking the people to run as fast as possible, which had the opposite effect, because the people were falling down, rushing out over each other, blocking the entrances, and it was rather slower. And I remember when I was coming to the entrance like that, I tried not to be hit, of course, like everybody did. So I usually try to go in the middle, not as outside, because easier for them to hit. And also I watched them whenever they lifted the whip and they swung, then I ran very quickly. By the time they lifted again, you know, I was already inside the tunnel. So I suppose it was not really, I suppose I had a kind of instinct of doing it automatically, really, like an animal. Probably I was 19, 18 at the time. And so I avoided being hit there. But some people were hit so strong that they were even killed. And it was happened over and over again. And then later on, they couldn't manage, was often, they couldn't manage to drive us into the tunnel every time. So there was a big trench, we had to dig a big trench around the perimeter of the camp, inside the camp, and they were driven into these trenches during the daytime. But the killing was going on all the time. And even in the last days, I suppose the Germans wanted to camouflage the evidence. So they killed so many people, there were heaps of them lying everywhere, you know, before the end of the war. I've got even some photographs of these heaps of the people there. And when the end of the war came, there was another camp near us. Well, I described to the end of the war, first of all. It happened on the 5th of May, 5 o'clock in the evening, a few days before the end, the SS man left the camp completely, and the guards were replaced by Volkssturm, which is army of old people over 60. And we didn't dare, of course, to go through the wires because they were still with the guns, and we weren't sure what the reaction would be. But they made the impression that they don't really care what is happening now. And then, where, and we, but the worst thing was this uncertainty, because rumors going from mouth to mouth, and we didn't have any food. Also, because during the last 4 days, well, the food was getting scarcer, although we were workless, because all the power stations were destroyed, you know, and we worked much less, but we were also getting less and less food. And during the last few days, we didn't get any at all. So probably 3 or 4 days, we didn't have anything to eat, really. And on this 5th of May, suddenly, about 5 o'clock in the evening, American men in a tank or a car appeared on the gate, and it was such a contrast, something like most incredible would have happened. It was this big war which lasted for so long, and there was small men dressed in kind of a gray uniform, and he said, "Now we are free. This is the end of the war for you." So there was a big silence for a moment, because I stood there in this Appel Place. There was big silence for a moment, and then everybody exploded with joy. People started singing, shouting, everybody his own language, and there were many nationalities in this Gusen. The majority were Polish. There were most Poles than the other people. The next were Russian. There were Spanish, French, Dutch, even 3 or 4 English, which were acting as interpreters and the end of the war. So this is how the war ended for us, and I soon afterwards I overate and I became very sick, but I recovered. I'm still alive, so I think this is all probably I have to say. I must have missed, you know, a lot of things probably during all this interview, but I think more or less I thought everything would happen to me then. And afterwards I made out, to the very end, I hope that my father is somewhere alive, but he disappeared somewhere during the war, nobody knows where.
Did you make a full recovery from your experiences?
It's very hard to say for me. It's very hard to say for me, but, well, I can add another small thing. This concentration camp and my experience during the camp and prisoner, they are never far away from me. I'll give you example what happened to me yesterday. I have a hernia, so I went to see a doctor. I had an appointment in hospital to see consultants in Northwood Park Hospital. And I waited to see the doctor for 3 hours. And I'm not a very patient person. I'm not furious, you know, I don't insult people and run around, but I'm not patient with myself. I hate waiting, don't know why. And so I started pacing up and down the corridor. Not the corridor, there was a big waiting room among the people, you know, they were up and down. And immediately we started pacing around there. The rhythm of my pace put me back into the past and put me back into the Warsaw prison, first of all, when I walked up and down and thought, what is going to happen, you know, in the cell, what is going to happen, whether I am going to be alive, whether my father is going to be alive, what is going to happen, and kind of uncertainty all the time. So for a moment or 2 moments, well, quite a long time really, I suddenly forgot what I am in the waiting room, and I thought that I'm in the prison again. And when, in the end, I tell you what happened, that in the end, I'm just, in the end, I went, I asked the secretary there who was dealing with this appointment, what happened, why am I in such a long time? And what really happened, that she misplaced my folder. She put my folder on the table, and the folder who had already interviewed the doctors, they put them into different file. And she put my folder into the file if I already had a doctor. So when they realized this thing, I went to a doctor, and I didn't exactly tell him, but probably I will, because I didn't want to upset him. But it was my longest waiting to see a doctor. I haven't even waited so long to see the assessment doctor when I was in Auschwitz. Although this doctor, must admit, was much nicer than the other one. I was frightened of him and very relieved. But when I saw assessment, I wasn't relieved. But nevertheless, he came quicker to see me than the one in Northwick Hospital. And I think, when you ask me, answering your question, I think that the concentration camp has got an influence in my life. But I don't think so that it had a negative influence, because whatever we live through, it has got influence on our childhood, our relation with the parents, relation probably with the wife, with the girlfriend, with the woman, whatever happens, there is already marked something inside you. So when I live through this camp, I am definitely, it's quite a things has left, but I think that quite a lot, if it's really positive, I wouldn't have learned so much about the life if I wasn't in the concentration camp. So paradoxically, it was probably kind of a school at the same time, or just a torture place.
Do you think your memories of the war are accurate?
Yes, but not 100%. I know this thing, because if I forget even something what has happened today, you know, when I put something and find it, so I must make this allowance that I, in general, yes, probably I mix the date, like I've forgotten this fun dozen, but other things which I describe, general impression, I think, is the right one. And another thing which I think which left from the war, but I think it's a good for me as well, that I don't really care very much about anything in my life, and maybe not in my nature, but it may be, it doesn't bother me very much, and I don't get very distressed about anything, because I never think that the world is so bad, really, because when I go back and think about the concentration camp, well, I think that everything compared with this is really very nice. But another thing which makes me feel, I don't know whether it's in my nature or probably concentration camp, that everything passes. And even when I worked, when I saw some other people, oh, this is important, the party is important, and the design of the bridges is important, I had to pretend that I am with them, because probably would have thought otherwise. I'm not a very good engineer. But on the other hand, I didn't think so seriously as they did about their work.
Thank you very much. Was there any revenge taking at Mauthausen or Gusen at the end of the war?
Oh yes, very much so. On the first day, soon after our liberation, three or four lorries full of food came into the camp, and they meant to be for distribution about the prisoners. But as they stopped on the Appellplatz, when roll call Platz, the people, the prisoners, rushed to these lorries when they saw the food on them, and the food perished in a matter of minutes, in spite of the protestation, but American army, and they couldn't really stop them. During this procedure, during this time, one of the internal capos, which was quite a cruel one, and he killed quite a lot of people, and he didn't manage to get away from the prison, from the concentration camp itself, because there were prisoners guards. As soon as the German went away, Polish people put the guards outside to make sure that prisoners, that criminals don't escape, but most of them did escape, but not all of them. So this couple didn't escape, and he was so unrealistic and so unaware of the changes we took in the camp, he thought that he would help Americans to manage the prisoners. And he only drew attention of prisoners to themselves. So in a moment, they abandoned the food. Well, not all of them, but quite a lot of them abandoned this food, and they rushed towards him. And there was a short shriek. I stood probably 20 yards from this lorry. Short shrieks, and when the crowd dispersed in about 10 or so minutes, the only shreds of this man were scattered on the ground. They tore or cut with the knives their hands and everything apart, and they threw them on the ground. And afterwards, as I walked in the camp just to have a look what was happening, I saw another couple being also caught by the prisoners, and he had a knife in his hand, and he tried to defend himself, and he was attacked by, if I remember right, by the Spanish people, because quite a lot of Spanish prisoners there from Spain who were taking the part against Franco, and they were interned in France, and when the German came, they put them into concentration camp. I think they were Spanish and Russian, and they called these prisoners, and they also tortured him, were breaking his hands, and I just couldn't stand his screams and so on, so I walked away. They also caught one prisoner. They lit a fire in the crematorium, because kind of a stove, which you could quite easily the fire in, they put him alive into this stove, but I didn't see it, you know, only I was told that it happened. But the biggest atrocity which was imprinted on my mind, it happened in the room where I stayed whilst working for Steyr. It was the same day or the following night after our liberation. I was lying in bed, and two Russians came into the room, and they were saying to each other, where Misha, one Russian was called Misha, I don't remember the other name, Misha, where is this policeman? And was internal policeman who was supervising us in Steyr, and he was also quite a cruel man. He killed few people and beaten many, including myself, and they had a torch, and they were walking from bed to bed and trying to find him out. And suddenly the man jumped out of bed, landed in the middle of the room, and ran toward the staircase, because we were on the first floor. There was one floor barracks, ground floor and first floor. And he ran down, but he was stopped by another prisoner who was going up, and he stabbed the prisoner, but it was not very serious, but it slowed him down for the Russian to catch up with him. And they brought him in the barrack, and they started breaking his leg. And this unforgettable to me, I still remember hearing the cracking of his bones and shrieking and screaming and pleading. And I just covered my head with the blankets, because I was rather frightened to intervene and didn't really enter my head, you know, that I should bother about it. And in the end, after some interval of time, he stopped screaming. So one Russian